Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, the historian Claire Potter, author of the new book Political Junkies, will talk about how the U.S. got to be so politically polarized. And then the science journalist Sonia Shah will talk about the dimensions of COVID-19 and other diseases beyond the purely biomedical. Before that, a few words on the U.S. economy. Thursday morning, the Census Bureau released data on retail sales for June. They are up 7.5%. Or a little less if you take out autos and gas, which are very volatile components. These follow double-digit gains in May. Among the strongest sectors were clothing, whose sales more than doubled in June, as well as furniture and electronics. Restaurant sales were also up strongly. But these numbers come with lots of asterisks. May and June's gains followed massively steep declines in March and especially April. According to a near real-time tracker of sales devised by a team led by the economist Raj Chetty, the sales gains happened mostly in the first 3 weeks of June. They've since flattened as the virus has ravaged the South and West. And those sales have been supported by the expanded unemployment benefits that began in March. Those benefits are slated to expire at the end of the month, and it's not clear if Congress will extend them. They are not just a boost to spending, of course, but a lifeline for people in great economic distress. Various reports show that between a quarter and a third of Americans are not paying rent or mortgages, meaning that we could be on the verge of a massive eviction and foreclosure crisis. Also on Thursday morning, the Labor Department reported that 1.3 million people filed for traditional state unemployment benefits last week, and another 928,000 filed for special pandemic benefits. Those special benefits are available to workers who are outside the normal system, like freelancers and contract workers. That 1.3 million number is being read in some circles as good news because it's the lowest since March. And the number drawing benefits fell slightly to 17.4 million, the lowest since mid-April. Aside from the fact that these numbers are still punishingly high, they overlook the numbers on special benefits. Combine those on special benefits with those on regular ones, and you get almost 32 million people drawing unemployment insurance checks, up more than a million from the week before. Florida and Georgia both saw huge rises in applications, and California and Washington saw big, though less than huge, rises. These numbers are almost certain to get worse in the coming weeks as the rising disease counts deepen their economic bite. It didn't have to be this bad, but since we're governed at the national level, and in quite a few states, by vicious morons, we've allowed COVID-19 to run wild. As a New Yorker, in a city and state hit hard and early by the pandemic, where we, after a slow start, finally brought our numbers down, I'm worried that visitors from the reckless states will begin pushing our numbers back up again. But there's really no substitute for national leadership on this, and we have none. It's curious that the countries with some of the worst COVID numbers in the world, the U.S., Britain, and Brazil, are run by reactionaries who are proud of their ignorance. Much the same can be said of the U.S. states whose ICUs are overflowing, like Georgia and Florida. They all have blood on their hands. On to my first guest. Claire Potter is a historian who is just out with a book called Political Junkies, From Talk Radio to Twitter, How Alternative Media Hooked Us on Politics and Broke Our Democracy, from Basic Books. She, like many others, is dismayed by the degradation of political discourse over the last few decades. As you'll hear, I'm not entirely convinced. It was always pretty degraded, although you could argue that Twitter takes it in new depths. Potter is a professor of history at the New School and is executive editor of Public Seminar, a digital magazine of politics and culture. Claire Potter. You open the book with a chapter on I.F. Stone, and I'm guessing that an awful lot of people today have very little idea who I.F. Stone was. So who was he, and why do you open the book with him?
I.F. Stone was a progressive journalist, and he began in journalism actually when he was a teenager in New Jersey, and he went to work for a newspaper. He worked in newspapers all the way through his high school years, and then went to the University of Pennsylvania. Stone was always a radical. He was actually a committed socialist, although he never really joined a party. He never joined a socialist party. He never joined the Communist Party, but he was committed to progressive ideas. And Stone actually left college after his freshman year, somewhat under duress, because he couldn't imagine a life away from journalism. So part of why I wanted to begin the volume with Stone is that it was people who were passionate about journalism and people who are passionate about politics are really the characters that make this book run. But Stone himself actually ultimately was blacklisted for his progressive politics. And in 1952, he finds himself without a job. The last progressive newspaper in New York, The Compass, which ran without advertising, was one of a series of newspapers that had run without advertising so that it would be politically independent, closed. And Stone was unable to get another job. It's really the depths of the McCarthy era. And so he kind of looks around at some other models and decides he's going to run his own newsletter. And he's going to do it through subscription so that he never has to be reliant on wealthy people. So he takes out a little ad in the New York Times that says, you know, I.F. Stone is starting a newsletter for only $5. You can get it for a year. What he also does is he gets mailing lists, and mailing lists are actually important later in the book. He gets mailing lists from The Nation, from the press that published his book in Korea, from the unions, particularly the teachers' union, and he sends out all of these flyers to people saying, you know, for only $5, you can get 4 pages of one in-depth story every week. And to his astonishment, a few days later, $5 bills start flowing in. And he's able to support himself and his wife and his children, who are almost grown up, on the strength of this money. But the thing that's really most important is that before there is an internet, I.F. Stone actually creates the template for what is going to become blogging.
Yeah, but he also, unlike many bloggers, he just, you know, talk off the top of their head or some less savory anatomical part. He actually did a lot of work. Much of what he did was publicly available information, but he really worked hard and developed.
No, it was not easy reading at all. And Stone, of course, had always been a genius investigative reporter. And one of the reasons for that, of course, is that he did not see well. He was legally blind. And at a very early age, he began to go deaf. So Stone was not able to compete in the Washington press conferences that really drove the news. But this turned out to be an advantage for him because he was also not relying on what he called inside sources. And Stone believed that not only were advertisers dangerous to the news, but relying on politicians for your information was bad journalism. As he always used to say, all governments lie. But the journalists would cut deals with politicians to not report certain kinds of things in order to keep those channels open. But I would also say that Stone prefigured really that first wave of blogging. People like Josh Marshall, for example, who would really do the kind of in-depth research on a story that a journalist didn't have time to do. If you were publishing every day, you couldn't really get into documents, whereas the early bloggers usually did something else for a living, and they had time and energy and the devotion to really dig deeply into a story and keep bringing it back into the news, which is what Stone did too. Stone was the first reporter to really report honestly about the Vietnam War, beginning in 1964, and he announced when he began that project that he was going to devote 2 years to it, and he did.
The second chapter is a bit of a surprise because it's about Robert McNeil and his partner, Jim Lehrer, and I recall that great essay that Alex Coburn wrote about the two of them, the Tedium Twins, he called them. You seem to have some nostalgia for that kind of serious high-mindedness that many of us find deeply dull in McNeil Lehrer. So what is the point of that second?
Well, I do have some nostalgia for it, Doug, in part because it was their coverage of the Watergate hearings that sucked me into politics, made me a political junkie, and I've never looked back. So that was part of it. But as I was really sort of exploring what they did, one of the things I realized is that first the Watergate coverage and then the NewsHour is conceived in a moment in which broadcast news is going into a series of convulsions. And those convulsions are based on a couple of things. One is that broadcast journalists had very little time to tell a story. But the other kind of convulsion was that because these were corporate entities that were producing broadcast news, they would shy away from reporting things that they thought their audiences wouldn't like. Because really what the broadcast news was about was assembling an audience for the big ticket advertising, which was evening entertainment. But the other thing is that McNeil felt very strongly that he was unconsciously aiding and abetting the prosecution of the Vietnam War in his role as a reporter and editor by having to cut out all of the things about the war that were horrifying. And he believed that if Americans actually saw what was happening in Vietnam, their stomachs would turn, but they were not allowed to see it. So I became interested in the idea of public television as coalescing a set of ideas about what alternative television could look like that we then later see emerging in early cable with community access television.
Now, what Alex Coburn's critique of the two of them in part was that they emerged out of the Watergate crisis, the oil crisis, a deep recession, a great sense of popular alienation and discontent. And the whole point of their sober-minded two sides of the story, which always usually excluded the far left, but we'll bracket that for now. But the whole approach was to narcotize that kind of discontent and to bring people back into the fold. You don't see it that way.
I don't really see it that way, but I understand why Coburn did see it that way, because, of course, they saw themselves as non-ideological. And I think it's a really important question whether there is such a thing. I think both you and I would agree that nothing is non-ideological. Everything's got an ideology. And that when it pretends not to have an ideology, that's the moment to prick up your ears. What I would say is some of their early shows were extraordinarily experimental. There's one I talk about in the chapter in which they were talking about the recession. And they assembled a group of out-of-work New Yorkers to talk to two congressmen about why Congress wasn't doing anything. And, you know, they had a New York City policeman, they had an African-American man who was a secretary who was unemployed, and they had, I think, a school teacher. And so what they did is they put these citizens in dialogue with the congressman, which was an unbelievable thing to do on television at that moment. One of the things that the NewsHour did over time is it, in and of itself, it became an institution. And it became an institution that deliberately spoke to a certain audience. So part of what I'm trying to set up in that chapter is what alternative media does. It identifies an audience that is actually narrowcast, not broadcast, and tailors itself to that audience's needs.
Okay, at the same time this was going on, a different conception of alternative was growing. The direct mail empires of Weyrich and Viguerie and these characters. How do they figure into this story of how we got here?
They figure into it in a couple of ways. One is Paul Weyrich and Richard Viguerie worked actively and consciously to divide the electorate. So part of what Political Junkies is trying to show is how, in fact, alternative media literally broke politics, actively worked to stop people talking to each other. And that story shifts around at different points in the book. But I thought it was very important to write a kind of prehistory of the right-wing Twitter sphere and blogosphere and so on that demonstrated that what happened in 2016 around the deliberate division and the creation of antagonisms between people had a much longer history, and that it began in a pre-digital era. And really, Viguerie is the crossover figure, because, of course, one of his great innovations is not only to get all of these addresses, but to buy a bunch of computer mainframes, which at the time were the size of about two steamer trunks, and put all that information on magnetized tape so that he could actually run the information for any group that wanted to get its message out. That itself is a kind of prehistory to MoveOn.org and ways of using email to raise money and identify your audience.
How do we get from there to the liberal appropriation of some of these techniques? You talk some about MoveOn as a player in this. They were pretending to be a unifying force, but in fact, they too are playing the game of division, weren't they?
Sure, they most certainly are. And I think one of the things I discovered when I dug deeply into this is how difficult it is to write a chronological history of either the right or the left without the other one in it. Because actually what I saw is they're watching each other all the time. And this process really accelerates in the 21st century. But as early as Viguerie, you are seeing liberals experimenting with other kinds of alternative media. Jerry Brown, for example, who famously used a 1-800 number to raise money for his campaign in, I think it was 1988, in any media format he was in, he would start shouting, you know, 1-800. And, you know, it was like those salesmen on UHF who were constantly trying to get us to buy Ginsu knives and so on. And, you know, it was considered by the political establishment to be extraordinarily low classy. But what Brown understood was that if you wanted to run outside the establishment, you had to ask the people to fund you.
Parenthetically, it's really funny to think of Jerry Brown as, with his anti-establishment pose, you know, son of a two-term governor of California. Totally emerged to the political establishment, but took up that outsider stance that has served many a politician very well over the years.
And it's interesting to talk about what people understand as an outsider stance, because people like Paul Weyrich and Richard Viguerie, for example, were thoroughly embedded in the Republican Party, but they were part of the Goldwater wing of the Republican Party that was actually fighting their own establishment. So the question of how people bring themselves back into the conversation through alternative media, and of course, by the time Brown is raising money with his 800 number, money is becoming more and more important to running a successful political campaign, regardless of who you are.
I'm speaking with the historian Clara Potter, author of Political Junkies, just out from Basic Books. The internet, of course, was supposed to be the savior of democracy. I remember the early theorists of the internet and people, enthusiasts on the well who emerged out of the well, and the Rheingold and Stuart Brand crowd. Remind us of just what the dreams were that the internet was going to do for us in its early days.
So it's important to remember about the internet that really it begins as a government-funded project, a military project, in fact, called ARPANET, which put the military and digital engineers and scientists in touch with each other. And they were the ones who sort of began pioneering some of the early practices that are with us today. For example, they named unwanted messages spam. They defined what it meant to troll and so on. But what they also understood themselves as was a like-minded community that was mutually invested in progress and democracy. Whether that's actually true or not is something we could debate, but that's certainly how they imagined themselves. And they saw the internet as it emerged as a platform that would encourage democracy by widening the scope of participation. So one of the things you begin to see is the emergence of this idea called electronic democracy, that the democracy that we lived with in what bloggers used to call the meat world was imperfect because people were constantly being shut out of the conversation, but that the internet would permit anybody who had a telephone line and a modem and a computer to be part of the conversation. And part of what you see is certainly in local political parties, communities seizing on this and saying, all right, everybody can't have a computer. Everybody can't afford an internet connection, but we could put them in libraries and we could create community-wide meetings. You see the school district in Detroit having a debate about segregation in Detroit and putting all of these electronics in gymnasiums all over the city so that the parents of all the children in the different neighborhoods could be part of that conversation. So there's this initial spurt of optimism that actually democratic participation, which is, of course, on the ropes in the 1980s, I mean, really, democratic participation has been sliding.
It's been on the ropes for a long time.
Right, exactly, for a very long time. So there's a lot of concern about this. And so there's this sort of burst of hope that this new exciting medium is going to suck people back in and revitalize democracy.
The dream, of course, was that it's going to be deliberative and civil. Now we get to the present and everyone's favorite whipping person, Twitter.
Yeah. Well, as you know, I love Twitter.
I know. We're both enthusiastic tweeters. We've tweeted some at each other.
Yes.
And it's a lot of fun. But a lot of people blame it for all kinds of terrible things. And of course, the current occupant of the Oval Office is a masterful tweeter. What is the contribution of that microblogging platform to the degradation of politics?
I think it's mixed. First of all, the idea that the internet was once civil and now it's not, I think is false. the earliest internet community, which was The Well, was famous for its disputes. And, you know, Katie Hafner wrote a book about it years ago. There was one sort of famous wrangle on The Well in which a couple was splitting up and the man was sort of abusing his wife relentlessly and trolling her and spreading lies about her. And the community of The Well had this whole discussion about trying to make him stop, and they decided not to. And, you know, even though they were deeply concerned about the woman's welfare, they decided that it would actually harm the democracy of what they had built to force anyone to stop. So there is this sort of very libertarian free speech position that is soldered into the internet and social media right from the get-go.
Yeah, you know, I ran a listserv for about 10 years. It was quite a healthy and thriving thing for a while. One of the things that taught me was that you really need a strong hand to moderate it, to tamp down this sort of thing. Otherwise, it devolves to absolute chaos.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, the other thing about incivility on the internet, I think, you know, there are a lot of people on the left who have rightly questioned why we keep ending up focused on incivility, since that becomes a catch-all for a variety of things you simply don't want to hear. Or someone telling you something that's true that happens to offend you. And, you know, we're in a moment right now as a society where white people have to be ready to be upset all the time because it's time for us to hear a lot of things from black and brown people that have not been spoken as loudly as they could have before. So I hesitate to worry about incivility. What I do think has happened, and I think this is something that begins to occur around 2004 with the Ron Paul campaign, is that people who are not necessarily attached to formal politics or formal institutions of any kind learn how to make trouble on the internet. There are a range of actors on the internet nowadays who are not necessarily concerned with having a robust and sometimes offensive political debate, but take a lot of pleasure in causing other people pain. So the advance of digital technology so that people can actually see, for example, where is their action on the internet? Oh, good, I can jump in and really mess with somebody's head here. That has become a factor in politics that is not necessarily political, but it certainly affects our political discourse dramatically.
Now, a lot of people like to blame Twitter for this, but you know, I think Pew reported a year or two ago that, 2% of the population or something like that is involved in political Twitter. People who are in the media and academia perhaps enhance its importance in their imaginations. But this idea that the internet can, it certainly promotes a lot of division. There's no question about that. But on the other hand, this is a deeply divided society with a lot of conflicts around class and race and gender and sexuality, region. What's the mix here? On this kind of analysis, are you overemphasizing the media angle and underemphasizing the real conflicts that are driving it?
I try not to, Doug. One of the parts of the book that I would really point to in this regard is the chapter that is about George Allen's Senate campaign and how he really gets knocked out by the bloggers. That's sort of a moment, 2006, that I think a lot of us think of as the golden age of blogging, before, in fact, newspapers became totally devoted to a blogging style and so on. But a time in which bloggers could actually keep a story in the news that the mainstream media didn't want to report. What I would say about all social media is that they carry on the tradition of forcing reporting about things that the mainstream media would rather not talk about. And I think one really good example of that was the accusations against Joe Biden by Tara Reid, which he claimed to have been trying to get reporters to talk about for a very, very long time. And it's not until she was on a podcast that the mainstream media was actually forced to investigate the story. That's really old school alternative media, which is a producer like Katie Halper deciding that she thinks it's a story and it ought to be reported and devoting herself to it and being willing to take knocks for it, which she clearly was, but pushing it back into the mainstream media and forcing an adjudication of it.
You end the book in kind of a hopeful note that we can all maybe get together and work together for a better society. I don't know. I have my doubts.
Well, once Donald Trump is gone, yes, we can get to work.
How's that going to work out?
I think it depends what people are willing to do. I think one of the things that I am very skeptical of is the sort of happy talk about media literacy. I think we do need better media literacy. I think we have needed better media literacy since, you know, the 1950s. But I don't think people developing better critical faculties about what they're seeing on the screen is really where we need to go. One of the things that needs to happen is we need to recognize what a lot of social media scholars have been saying for a long time, which is Google and Twitter and Facebook are corporations. They are mainly devoted to advertising and data collection that can be sold for advertising. We need to regulate them as corporations. And unfortunately, one of the things these companies were able to do back in 1996 is support the passage of a law that makes them explicitly not accountable for anything that appears on their platforms. And this isn't just a problem for politics. It's a problem for things like revenge porn.
Yeah, but do we really want Google and Twitter regulating the content or Facebook regulating the content of what's on those platforms?
I think we don't want to regulate free speech. I think if we could control the bots, that would be a very important step. It's not clear to me whether these companies actually don't know how to do it and they simply don't want to admit that they don't know how to do it, or whether they're refusing to do it. Because I think where we end up with problems is not people disagreeing vigorously, not even people being angry at each other online, but when things that are simply not true are being disseminated so widely. The emergence of fake news as a real factor in elections is something that actually we do need to be deeply concerned about, and that if these corporations refuse to regulate it, I do in fact think the Federal Communications Board should step in to do it. Yes.
Yeah, someone who is suspended for a day from Facebook for posting jokingly, ironically, that men are trash. And there's no appeal to the Facebook gods. I don't know. It makes me nervous to think about repealing that 96 law.
Absolutely. It should make you nervous. And, you know, at the time, I thought that you were taken out by an AI. And I think part of what this shows is the laziness of these platforms and the cheapness of it. They don't want to hire the people that they need to hire to actually do the work. And I think that is a huge problem, too. I don't think taking out individuals is really the problem. I think it's the networks that are doing terrible damage that we really need to think about. Or also other forms of alternative media like Breitbart, who report explicitly false stories. And you'll have a fake headline, and then the actual story will be this kind of like anodyne, vague thing that doesn't actually support the headline. But what they're counting on is everybody seeing the headline and passing it on. That, I think, is a problem, and I think it's something that either needs to be voluntarily addressed by these giant media corporations, or the government needs to bring them to the table to do it.
That was Claire Potter, author of Political Junkies from Basic Books. She's also a professor of history at the New School and is executive editor of Public Seminar, a digital magazine of politics and culture. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. How is some of Where Have All the Good Times Gone by the Kinks? It's a question I often ask myself these days. The reason for asking that question is, of course, this damned pandemic. My next guest, the science journalist Sonia Shah, has an article in The Nation on how we're not really talking about COVID-19 in useful ways. Shah's book, Pandemic, Tracking Contagion from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, was published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux in 2016. Her most recent book, The Next Great Migration, The Terror and Beauty of Life on the Move, was published in June. Sonia Shah. You point out that war metaphors are really dominating a lot of the discourse around COVID. One I saw recently that really struck me was someone who said that teachers should go back to class in the spirit of the GIs invading Normandy.
right.
Easy for him to say. But what does this tell us, this prominence of war metaphors in our relationship to a disease?
I mean, I think we've made microbes as the, you know, they're the kind of boogeyman of all this. And of course, the virus is a key factor in infectious diseases of all kinds, right? Whatever the precipitating microbe is. But contagions happen in context. So this idea that the coronavirus alone is the whole problem, you know, the whole problem is that this virus exists in the world and we have to repel it with all of our military might, is to erase all of the social and political and environmental drivers, because we live in a microbial world, right? So microbes emerge and become pathogens because we provide them with opportunities. And that can shape our response in different ways, right?
Yeah, like in normal times, New York City subway is like a germ zoo, but most of us don't get sick from it. So what does that tell us about sickness and pathogens?
Well, it tells us that that disease occurs in a certain context. So just because a pathogen or a certain microbe that can cause disease in one individual is present in a society, in a population, it doesn't mean that those people are also going to get sick. So, for example, look at malaria parasites. There are malaria parasites all over parts of sub-Saharan Africa, right? It's very common. But most people don't die of it. But some people don't even get sick from them at all. But if you or I, who live here in North America, were to go into those disease environments and be exposed to malaria parasites, we would get very sick. So it really depends on an interaction between what is your immune status, what are the other microbes you have inside your body. All of these interactions is where disease sort of unfolds. So it's not as simple as if the pathogen is there, you will get sick. It's much more complex than that. And this is something that people who study infectious diseases know. We've known this for many years. It's an interactive process and it varies from person to person, which we're already seeing even with the coronavirus. Some people are getting exposed and not getting sick. Some people are getting exposed to just a little bit and they're getting very sick. So where does all that variety come from? Just the simple absence or presence of the pathogen does not explain the whole phenomenon.
In your piece, you open with anecdotes about cholera and the spread of cholera in the 19th century and the initial theories that people had about it. Just tell us what people thought and what they did to try to stave it off before they actually got a little more successful at it.
Right. So we had cholera epidemics in this country for the better part of a century. And when cholera came over, what we can see now, because they collected data that we still have to this day, and we can map it, we can see that cholera came over on the transatlantic shipping lanes into North America and then kind of filtered throughout the continent on our waterways, on our canals, on our rivers, etc. But that's not how people thought of contagious diseases at the time. They didn't think contagious diseases traveled in things like water. They thought contagions were something that were in the atmosphere. It was because we were exposed to these big clouds of smelly gases and miasmas, as they called them. So the idea about cholera, when cholera first emerged, was that, well, this must be something that we inhale. That's why we're getting sick, is we're inhaling something that's deadly. And so even though they collected data that showed very clearly cholera was traveling down the Hudson River, down the Erie Canal, heading to New York City, coming in through the ports, you know, it was very clearly connected to shipping traffic. They decided, well, this is something that's in the air. And so we need to do things like string up big pieces of meat to absorb the cholera vapors, or more deadly things like, well, we have all these outhouses and latrines and privies, and it smells so bad. So we need to get rid of all these smells. So let's install flush toilets and dump all of that material into our drinking water, because
the drinking water doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how dirty it is or contaminated it is. What matters is we don't smell it anymore. And so in the city of London, in fact, they installed more flush toilets after every cholera outbreak rather than fewer. So they, you know, were actually exacerbating the spread of the disease.
Of course, even the name malaria, Italian for bad air, right? So there's just the sense that there's coming in over the air and like we need to purify it.
Yes, it was a very old idea. And I think the idea of miasmas in medicine was so persistent, you know, thousands of years. This traces back to Hippocrates' time. And I think it's because it did work. It did make a certain amount of sense for diseases like malaria, which were considered, you know, diseases of the air and of the atmosphere. And of course, we know today that, you know, you don't get malaria from the air, but you do get it from mosquitoes, which travel through the air. So if you were to avoid places where there were these low-lying, smelly airs, like around swamps or wetlands, for example, you might actually avoid some cases of malaria. So it probably seemed to make sense for many years.
And going back to the war metaphors, so often our reaction to diseases is to blame somebody else. You know, the Spanish flu, which probably originated in the U.S., is called the Spanish flu. Trump and his crowd love to call it the China virus or the Wuhan virus. It's always somebody else that's responsible, some kind of foreign invader that we need to repel.
Yeah, that's true. And that becomes very clear when you look at other pathogens that we can't do that too. So, for example, antibiotic resistant pathogens. This is a huge problem. When I was writing my book, Pandemic, I would talk to infectious disease experts and ask them, well, which are the pathogens that keep you up at night that you think, you know, might cause the next pandemic? And they would say a respiratory pathogen like the flu, but only a little more deadly, which is what we have today with coronavirus. But the second one they always said was a highly drug resistant form of bacterial pathogen, you know, one of these super bugs. And we have a lot of those in this country, but the way we talk about it is completely different than the way we talk about some pathogen that we can trace to, say, parts of Africa or parts of Asia. You know, those get called after their names, like Ebola, named after a river in Congo, or the coronavirus, which we have so many people are desperately trying to call it the Wuhan virus or the China virus. Antibiotic-resistant pathogens are homegrown pathogens. We create those right here in the United States. We talk about it in a completely different way. You know, we don't call it the, you know, the Boston plague or the San Francisco rash or, you know, whatever. We don't use those terms at all. In fact, the whole narrative about homegrown pathogens is completely different from the ones that we can tag to foreign peoples or foreign places.
Early in the AIDS crisis, it was often said that it was a disease of the four H's, homosexuals, heroin users, Haitians, and hemophiliacs. The implication was that it wasn't something that normal suburban white people had to worry about. That's not a very helpful way of seeing things.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I don't think I could say for sure. I mean, certainly it's tied into our paradigm about being sort of uncontaminated and pure, and the problem is foreign encroachment of some, you know, contaminant or something that interferes with our sort of purity. I think all of these paradigms illuminate some parts of the disease process and obscure others. So in the case of this paradigm that we're living under now, it really heightens all the activity of the pathogen itself. And so it really heightens our emphasis on finding tools and weapons that can control that pathogen, drugs, vaccines, other biomedical interventions. And we're laser focused on that pathogen itself and how to corral it and to squelch it. But what we then miss are all the larger transmission opportunities and behaviors that actually help the pathogen move between us, all the dynamics within our bodies that sometimes make us sick and sometimes don't. You know, we're missing a lot of the picture. But I think that's true with any paradigm. You know, any paradigm, you're going to see parts of the problem and dismiss or marginalize other parts of the problem. It was the same thing with miasmatism. It maybe made sense for malaria and some of the old diseases, but it didn't make sense for the new diseases that came up, like cholera at that time in the 19th century.
I'm speaking with the science journalist Sonia Shaw. Zoonotic diseases, ones that leap from animals to humans, have caused us a lot of trouble in recent decades. You know, the SARS, Ebola, COVID. We, of course, can trace viral transmission from bats and whatever to humans. But what does that kind of analysis leave out in understanding the disease?
Well, you're right. I mean, since the 1940s, we've had hundreds of these pathogens either newly emerge like coronavirus or re-emerge into new territory like cholera, which has annexed Haiti just recently in, you know, in the last decade or so. Malaria taking over parts of Southern Europe again. So, you know, this is sort of a big picture thing that's happening. And I think when we just focus on each pathogen in its in isolation, what we miss is this big picture that we're having dozens of these things emerge, and they're all, you know, coming out of a similar kind of process. About 60% of the pathogens that we're seeing today originate in the bodies of animals, about 70% in the bodies of wild animals. And the reason that's happening on a large scale is because we are invading so much wildlife habitat. And of course, when we do that, we lose a lot of wildlife, which is why we have this massive biodiversity crisis, losing 150 species every day that are going extinct forever. But the ones that remain have to crowd into ever smaller and smaller pieces of, you know, habitat that are little fragments and more frequently in close contact to where we live. You know, if we cut down the trees where the bats live, they don't just disappear. They come and live in the trees in our gardens and our farms and our backyards instead. And so we're bringing wild animals into closer contact with us because we're destroying so much of their habitat. They're forced to come closer and closer to where we live. And that facilitates these spillover events where microbes that live in animal bodies quite harmlessly, not causing them any problem at all, find their way into human bodies. And like any microbe, you know, you find yourself in a new territory, you exploit it. You start to, you know, take advantage of this new opportunity, new place to live. Yeah, I'm going to, you know, try to refine my ability to feed on these kinds of tissues. It's what living things do. And so we're providing those opportunities because of the way we're interacting with nature and the landscape.
Now, you mentioned this before, but I'd like to develop the point. There are social patterns to the transmission of COVID-19, you know, like jails. But we also know that poor and black and brown people are more susceptible. What does this tell us about the social dimensions of disease transmission and a more effective approach to managing it?
We're seeing the early signs of some of the social and political drivers, but I don't think we have a full picture yet. I mean, in terms of disproportionate impact on poor people and minorities, we're definitely seeing that, but it's actually not as pronounced as some of the other diseases we have. You know, if you look at sort of the bigger picture of contagious diseases around the world, they're almost entirely focused on poor, marginalized people, which is why we don't really do much about them, right? Like diarrheal diseases, there's a million of them, and they take hundreds of thousands of lives every year. We hardly do anything about it, even though we have cures, we know how to prevent it, we know how to deal with those problems. COVID, it has a disproportionate impact for sure, but it also is... Bolsonaro has COVID now, right? It's not entirely ghettoized in poor marginalized community, which is why we're paying attention to it. You know, if it was entirely ghettoized, like cholera, like malaria or tuberculosis or any of the many diseases that, you know, global health experts call neglected diseases, and they're neglected because they affect poor people, and so we don't spend any money on them. So anyway, that's a long circuitous response to what you said. Sorry about that, Doug. But basically, I think what we really need to do is to spend a lot more time and energy on those social questions. We aren't. I mean, that kind of science right now is very much on the margins. I mean, we should know in much more detail. We should be spending the billions of dollars that we're spending on, you know, throwing at drug companies that have never developed a single vaccine to develop some new vaccine before the election. We should be spending that money on science that tells us about transmission dynamics in marginalized communities and how is it spreading and what is the infectious dose? Like, what are the behaviors that actually make it more likely to spread from one person to the other? What are the high risk conditions that make us more likely to get sick? I mean, those should really be the central questions. They are questions we are looking at right now, but that science is on the margins. The money, the attention is on the vaccine development and the drug development. So, and I think that's sort of the impact of a paradigm that says the pathogen is the whole problem. The invasion of the pathogen is the, you know, the entirety of what we're facing.
Well, we do know that food processing plants and prisons and overcrowded housing contribute a lot to the spread of COVID, and we don't seem very prepared to do much of anything about that.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting is if it was just that, then I think we wouldn't do anything at all. But it's also, you know, nightclubs and bars and cruise ships,
bars and
things
college
like that,
towns,
right? Right. So if it was just meatpacking plants where immigrants worked and just overcrowded housing in, you know, poor neighborhoods, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. This wouldn't even be a front page thing, because there's many diseases that are like that we already have that are sometimes more deadly than this one and which we ignore. So this disease is actually the sociality of it is actually more complex, which is why we're even, you know, why we're in this predicament of actually like dealing with it on the large scale that we are. Usually most of these diseases don't affect, you know, a diversity across the demographic spectrum. They're much more marginalized, much more ghettoized. And so we tend to ignore it.
Of course, the U.S. has done a particularly bad job at managing this, though. Why do you think that we've done so badly?
The response has been catastrophic. And I've been asked many times since this happened, since I wrote my book, Pandemic, came out in 2016. So, of course, there hadn't been any major pandemic yet. And I've been asked many times, well, what is most surprising about the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, having just written a book about how pandemics form and when the next one might come? And none of it really is very surprising. It's pretty much unfolding the way many pandemics have in the past, except for the completely chaotic U.S. response, a criminally negligent U.S. response, which I don't think anyone could have predicted, that the CDC, which was just an absolute shining light in this world of disease control for so many years, that it would become this, you know, propagandistic kind of agency that was so weakened by the administration. So, you know, that the response of the U.S. has been the most sort of surprising part of this pandemic. And I think it actually has empowered a lot of bad responses on the part of other governments too, like Brazil or India, et cetera.
Yeah. So finally, climate change promises lots more of this, right? What does that hold for us in the future?
Well, I mean, the changing climate is going to create some opportunities for pathogens to move into new places, into new populations. It will also create barriers for some pathogens that are already in certain places. So you're going to, you know, you're changing the map of where pathogens and diseases can be sustained. So in some cases, you know, you take a disease like mosquito-borne diseases, for example. If it rains a lot, that could mean that you're going to have more standing water, there's going to be more puddles around, there's going to be more mosquitoes, and then you're going to have more mosquito-borne disease. Or if it rains a lot, it could also mean that you wash away all the mosquito eggs because, you know, they're in stagnant water and they just get washed away in the torrents of floodwaters. So it's going to be a variable. You know, it's going to be variable. The actual amount, the excess disease that we get might be balanced by the, you know, less disease we get in certain areas too. But the overall picture is that because the places where diseases occur are going to change, new populations will be exposed to them. And what we know as we're living through right now is when a population is exposed to a pathogen that it's never encountered before, that's a very violent confrontation because we don't have any acquired immunity or you know, any genetic immunity to these things. So just by changing the map, even though overall maybe you'll have the same amount of disease or, you know, it's not going to necessarily all be more disease. In some places, there'll be less. But if you have new kinds of people, new populations exposed to pathogens, they do become more sick. So the burden of disease, I think, is probably going to increase.
And are we doing enough to prepare for these changes, like studying them and, you know, making plans? Or are we just taking a very casual attitude, as it seems likely?
Yeah. I mean, I think since we've had
antibiotics have minimized and marginalized contagions as if they are minor issues. You know, we get an infection nowadays, you know, before coronavirus, and it was considered pretty run-of-the-mill. You take a $20 course of antibiotics and that's it, you're done. You don't have to think too deeply about it, right? You don't have to think about like your behavior or your job or your interaction with other people or with society. You don't have to think about any of that stuff because you just pop a few pills. The cost is minimal and you move on. But when we have these new diseases emerging, we don't have those tools anymore. So we need to really reimagine what infectious diseases mean. These are not things that we can easily control by throwing a new drug or new vaccine at. We have this sort of triumphalist sense of the power of our biomedical interventions. You know, this idea that, well, of course we can get a vaccine and of course it will solve this problem. In fact, one disease in human history that we have actually completely eradicated through vaccination, and that was smallpox. And that was not, you know, the smallpox vaccine wasn't based on high-tech modern technology. It was based on a centuries-old folk remedy that originated in Africa and Asia. So, you know, we have this sense that somehow the drug companies are going to save us with some, you know, newfangled new product. And I think what this era of emerging diseases is going to teach us is that that's not enough. You can't develop a drug or vaccine fast enough to protect yourself from the first wave of disease. And that is always the most deadly because that's when you have, you know, no experience of the microbe to begin with. So, and we're seeing that right now.
That was a science journalist, Sonia Shaw. Well, I appreciate the importance of thinking about the pandemic in more than high-tech medical intervention ways. I must confess to a hope that they really do come up with a vaccine soon. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, David Bowie's version of the Kinks song we heard a bit of earlier. Till next week, bye. Felt the same.